Are you interested in moving more in your life, not only for your physical health, but for your mental health and for your family and community's health? We're going to explore ways to practice more nutritious movement today with biomechanist Katie Bowman on Your Life in Process. Movement is one of the foundations of my well-being, my family's well-being, and one of the things that I encourage my clients to do more of. A lot of us think about movement in terms of exercise, but exercise is really just one component of movement. We can move our eyes, we can move our lungs, we can move our blood, we can move the sides of our body by how we breathe, and we are not moving enough. We live in a culture that is quite sedentary, and that sedentarism has impacts not only on our physical health, but our mental health and our relationships health. Today, we're going to talk with somebody who's really changed my paradigm around movement, biomechanist Katie Bowman. She's a best-selling author, a speaker, a leader in the movement, and she's changing the way we move and think about our need for movement. Her 8 books, including the groundbreaking Move Your DNA, have been translated into more than a dozen languages worldwide. And she is one of Maria Shriver's architects of change, who has worked with companies like Patagonia, Nike, and Google, as well as a wide range of nonprofits and other communities, sharing her move more body parts message. Her movement education company, Nutritious Movement, is based in Washington State, where she lives with her family. And in this episode, we will talk about why the variety of your movement matters in terms of your health and how to move in a way that meets many of your categories of needs at once. So the categories being things like needing to get food made, needing to have time with your family, maybe time with yourself, time in nature, and downtime. Katie talks about this concept of stacking your life for more movement. And she writes that the key to moving more is stacking your life in taking all of these categories of needs that you have, and instead of trying to meet them one at a time, doing something that fulfills many needs at the same time. We're going to look at movement in many different contexts. Movement in terms of our culture, movement in terms of our clothes, movement in terms of our learning and our work, movement in terms of our aging, and even movement in terms of our celebration. Stay tuned for the end when Katie and I talk about our favorite walks of all time. And I highly recommend you do some movement during this episode. Put in your earbuds and take a walk, get on the floor and do some stretching, some legs up the wall, move your body while we're talking about movement, and you will not only feel better by the end of the episode, you will also be more likely to remember it because movement has so many cognitive benefits for you as well. Stay tuned for the other side where I'm going to give you some specific things to try out this week to move more nutritiously in your life. I want to tell you about some opportunities to move your body more, move more nutritiously, and move more in nature. I'm going to be joining forces with UCSB's Commission on Student Wellbeing on May 27th out at Campus Point, and I'm going to be leading students through a mindful walk along the bluffs to the labyrinth there. You can learn more at my website, drdianahill.com. If you want to move your body more nutritiously on a regular basis, I highly recommend you check out Yoga Soup. I've been practicing with Yoga Soup for over 20 years, and one of the things that really inspires me about their work is the variety of offerings. Everything from Kundalini yoga to meditation to active stretching to sound healing. It's a community and it's a nutritious soup of movement. So come join me in person at Yoga Soup or practice online at yogasoup.com. Here's Katie Bowman. This is, I think, the third maybe interview I've done with you, Katie, but I feel like I want to keep bringing you back because, one, I need the reminders and the reboots to move more nutritiously in my life, and two, you of people outside of the field of psychology, you have changed my life the most in terms and my family's life. So I'm hoping today we can talk about what that has been like in terms of nutritious movement and how movement isn't just about exercise, but also help our listeners begin to shift their lifestyle around moving more. So let's just start with a good, maybe a good place to start is just sedentary culture and what's happening to us. Why are we, why is this a problem?
So I mean, just to call out maybe the elephant that's sitting in the room, which is we have become quite sedentary. And I really mean humans over, you know, the human timeline have been sort of stepping towards sedentarism, but it's really been accelerated. And you can see that acceleration starting with the Industrial Revolution, and then you can see it from there with the Technological Revolution. And then even now with, I would say, Smart Technology Revolution is another bump into it going faster than it had previously gone. So if you just think of your own family history, maybe your great-grandparents and then your grandparents and your parents and then you, if you have children or you see children around in the community, there's been a steady decline of movement. And it has physiological, it has certainly mental health impact. And I don't think we've really named it. I mean, certainly the problem is being investigated often. But I don't think it's really named in the way beyond, we all need to exercise. And our great-grandparents were exercising, and our grandparents, you know, weren't, they didn't live a lifestyle of exercise. They lived a lifestyle of movement. And so, it's to, one, recognize that there's an issue that's really impacting us in a lot of different ways, not just our own physical body, but sort of there's social issues, there's environmental issues that go lockstep with, you know, our lack thereof stepping, so to speak. I spend a lot of time fleshing out what that issue is and talking through solutions, coming up with solutions.
The solution that we've had has been exercise. And when I think about my own movement history, I grew up in a real moving family. They were gardeners. We did backpacking trips. Our Sundays were collecting oranges under the orange tree. So there was a lot of movement early on. But somewhere in junior high-ish, I caught on to the exercise concept, Jane Fonda videos, and then it was Buns of Steel. Mm-hmm. So a lot of my movement just got kind of squeezed into this paradigm of changing my body is the reason why I wanted to move more, as opposed to the joy of movement or just movement as part of lifestyle. And that's, I'm just noticing that as one of the barriers to actually moving more in our lives, is that we've kind of turned movement into this one little sliver of experience.
Well, you know, I agree. I mean, that's why I spend a lot of time differentiating between movement and exercise and movement and physical activity and exercise. And now I'm really trying to flesh out this new category, which is labor. And that's a completely separate category. There's certainly overlap, but they're all involving using your body. But like you said, the motivation, there's like been a hijacking of movement, pulling out exercise as the main thing. And I think it has a lot to do with perhaps the research early on of going, we can't really be this sedentary. We need some sort of solution. And exercise became the thing that was researched and promoted, you know, letting everybody know we can't be this still. Here's what you can do about it. And then, you know, of course, the benefits were, and then you can look a certain way, perhaps, certainly feel better, but it is so overly bound with personal well-being. And then, of course, the second piece of physical appearance, that everything else that movement used to be used for and all the other benefits that used to come tied with it have also fallen away with the understanding. So that's part of, I think, part of the solution is going to be, is going to involve really appreciating the definitions of movement and what it is and what it's used for, because it makes it more applicable to more people's lives.
Yeah. So I want to talk a bit about that, because you coined the term nutritious movement, and it's such a great terminology. We understand nutrition in terms of our food, and maybe we're a little bit further along in terms of understanding we need variety of food, and, you know, just eating even one nutritious food isn't nutritious, right? If you were just only to eat bananas, it's not going to be good for you. But talk to me about nutritious movement and how it moves beyond sort of this paradigm of just exercising more or that more movement is better.
Well, nutritious movement is this term, which is to liken movement to nutrients. You need it. You need a wide variety of it, and you need it sort of sprinkled throughout the day, very similar to how we need to be eating. Hopefully, and I don't think that everyone has a broad sense of nutrition. I used to think so, but now I'm realizing, I don't think that everyone knows that there's a range of macronutrients and micronutrients, and that when we don't get certain ones, there's these health issues that arise. And the same goes for movement. There are many people who are regular exercisers, and they're thinking, well, I move adequately. So that these physical issues that I'm having can't relate to my movement diet, so to speak. And I think that movement diet is a main piece of the nutritious movement's perspective, which is you're moving all the time, whether you realize it or not. Even us sitting here having this discussion, this is a mechanical environment that we are in. We're not exercising right now, but maybe we're sitting in a unique position or standing. You are moving all the time. And chances are the spectrum of movement that you're getting, even if you exercise, isn't meeting your individual particular needs, because every one of your parts needs to be moving. Like, that's the challenging thing, is your whole body needs to move, yes, but all of your individual parts need to as well. And it could be that your current exercise practice is not moving all of you as much as you think it is. It's certainly not moving it as frequently as perhaps you need to be moving. So like nutrition, there is not only the calories consumed, but there is the types of calories and then the distribution and the relationship between the calories or the dietary nutrients. And the same goes for mechanical nutrients.
Yes. So we need to be moving our parts in lots of varieties of directions and lots of different ways. And actually, I was just listening to one of your podcasts that just came out that you were talking about the activity tracker.
Yeah.
Where you write down all the things that you do in a day, and then how many hours you spend on each thing, and then you categorize them based on types of movements. And I'm not doing enough throwing and kicking.
it's so helpful. I made that piece and that tracker, and I think it really drives the point home, because you can fill it in, and you're like, man, even if your minutes per day of movement is really high. I mean, there are certainly people who have labor-centric professions. Mm-hmm.
Builders
and yeah. I mean, a large portion of people are still, they would not fall into the sedentary category, but their movement diet still is problematic, because it tends to be a lot of the same movements again and again and again. Yeah. So just like a nutritionist would look at your diet and say, whoa, you're getting a lot of this category, but nothing over here. We need to diversify just a little bit in terms of macro and micronutrients. So it would be the types of things that you're doing, but also which body parts that they're using. So I think, yes, if none of this makes sense, go at least sit in front of the tracker, and it will reveal itself by you just filling in the boxes, which is what's so great about trackers.
Yes. And some of the things that I think I've changed in my life to put more variety in based on some of your suggestions. One of the things that I used to not do a lot of was hanging from arms. I think a lot of people don't hang from their arms.
Yeah, I don't. Sure.
And so just changing some stuff in my house and changing some habits so that I'm cued to do it has helped me do more hanging. Things like having a trapeze in our playroom, things like walking through the doorway and reaching up that you taught. And then also playing on the trees when my kids play on the trees, grabbing a tree if a kid's grabbing a tree. So let's talk a little bit about in Grow Wild, you break down how our world and our culture shapes our movement, and these different categories, these different containers that either facilitate more nutritious movement, more variety, or facilitate more sedentaryism. Let's go through some of those, and maybe you can give us some ideas to build more movement, more variety of movement in our life. So the first one is the container of our culture. And you describe movement as actually being counterculture.
Sure. There's a resistance to moving. There's an active promotion of sedentarism. And I don't think that our culture would identify itself as sedentary culture, because it'd be like, look at all the promotion of activity that we're doing. But at the same time, we're constantly being discouraged to move for other reasons that maybe allow the culture to function as it's been functioning. So that's just signage and expectations. You know, some of it's implicit, some of it's explicit. I wrote the book Grow Wild thinking about children, but I've had so many people talk about their office culture, you know, as I feel like I can't wear flat shoes. I have to wear high heels. And like, that's really important, the words that you're saying. You're saying, I mean, there's certainly, unless I have a couple of people who work in the airline industry and it is explicit, you must, if you are a woman, wear high heels as part of your uniform. It's not explicit in that way. It's more just the pressure or the assumptions about what someone who is professional looks like and what they'll behave like. And I think that we have similar expectations, certainly on children, right? That children are at one point seen and not heard. And then now it's become, you know, maybe you could be heard, but you better be sitting down and raising your hand before you're hurt. You know, like things that are just, we all grew up in it. Not even sure maybe the origins of some of those things. But yeah, like it's just about the rules, whether they're just understood rules or whether it's a giant no jumping. I just got back from the airport on that trip to California that we were talking about earlier, and there were no ways to walk around this airport on foot. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was no pedestrians allowed, and so we could either choose to like hire a car to move through one particular area, or get in trouble, or you could find some other way to sort of finagle your way around on foot, but it wasn't built for being able to move. And I took a picture of it, of course, because no walking here has to deal with the flow. You know, it has to do with the flow of what the airport needs as a culture. But as we move into these really fast, high-tech spaces that are major concentration sites for a large number of people, most of them in cars, the rules about individual movement start being influenced by some of the choices that we have either understood we were making or made just by going along with it. So movement is definitely one of the things that's most affected.
One of the things that gets paired up with this is a no movement activity is thinking and cognition. Like if you're going to think about something, you better sit down at a desk and think hard about it. And that's sort of trained up early on in our education system and then continues to be trained up in our work settings. But the research is so counter to that.
Sure.
That you are cognitively, you perform so much better when you are moving or after you've moved in all levels, whether it's your attention span is better or your memory and learning is better or your creativity is better. Even just walking makes us think better. But I think that culturally, we think that we need to sit to think. And as thinking has become more valued, we sit more, which is interesting for me as a therapist, because that's what I've been trying to figure this out for a while, is how do I move more in what's considered to be such a sedentary, culturally sedentary job, or expected to be sedentary?
Well, I just was talking with a friend who's very active, and she had just started seeing a new therapist, and she had found him, and on his website, he offered walking and running therapy sessions. And you know, she snatched that up quite quickly, because same thing, she has her work day and her therapy time, you know, her personal well-being time is going to fit outside of her also already sitting job and all these other things. And so she called and booked a session, and and the therapist had said that she was the one of maybe only one or two other people who had ever taken him up on that offering, but he kept it up because he was just hoping that it would let people know that therapy was still available and just as good, if not from the from my friend's perspective, she said better because she didn't feel stressed about, you know, like we all have this list of things to do every day. And she was having to choose between types of personal well-being. Do I take the mental health well-being sitting down, or do I take the physical well-being on the move, which will also help my mental well-being? So you're constantly having to negotiate. And she just felt like she didn't have to negotiate by making that choice and felt better overall because she was doing more of what her body needed, all of her parts, including her mind. Mm-hmm. But she felt that the therapy itself was better, less confrontational, more, like she said, faster answers, more creativity. The individual was able to listen and participate, maybe because more of their own needs were being met. So I just think of that as really ultimately, you know, stacked, as we like to say.
Yeah. I've also taken your cues around structuring my environment to just support variety for me in my day. So like over here, I'll show you my little, I don't know if you can see this. Over here is like a little floor space where we can sit on the floor. I have a couch. I can see over here, these doors that go outside. So when people are in here, they're looking at not just me close up, but they can look at things that are far away. And then I have a ball I can sit on, or sometimes I'll sit on cushions. It's just sort of the consciously trying to have lots of different ways to be, because I'm seeing six hours mm-hmm. a day of face-to-face with someone. And what I found is that when I do that and I don't move, which is how I started my practice in my 20s and early 30s, I would feel terrible physically at the end of the day. And then also just really tired by, you know, fatigued from sitting, which is kind of an interesting concept.
Can I ask a question?
Yeah.
About, do you communicate with your individuals coming in about this experience that they could potentially have before they come in? Like, do they know, is that something that you offer in the write-up of your services, saying I offer like a flexible seating situation? I'm just curious because professionals ask me all the time about how can I do this?
Yeah.
And I also talk about it for schools when you start move to flexible seating, about how to manage the expectations by sort of opening up the what you're doing instead of having it sort of arrive when you come up expecting something different.
Yeah. This is what I need to work on. And this is part of my own internal, maybe it's like mindset around, I feel like I'm a little bit outside of the box of what a psychologist would do. The way that I set it up is when you come to my office, you can expect like a short walk through some fruit trees to get here. I'm kind of off in the kind of middle of nowhere. But I don't say explicitly on my website, when you come in, you'll be able to sit on the floor, or you can choose a ball, or we could choose to do a walking session. And I think I would like to do that, but maybe it's my own culture container that's been limiting me in making it more explicit. And also the container of, you know, what the APA trust says and what is therapy. And there's all these concerns about confidentiality and sure. all sorts of things. So that's the next frontier for me, Katie.
Well, I like it. And I think everyone, you know, who's thinking about doing this in whatever profession they are is really limited by their container and the expectations of their container. Sometimes certainly the explicit legalities of their container, right? Like that's a reality that everyone has to negotiate. But I mean, I was just thinking, I feel like I've focused on effective communication, managing expectations. That's something that I really tuned into as a parent. Mm-hmm. I would always want to put on some piece like movement is so important for some of these things. I know that we're all struggling time-wise. So I have set up this opportunity, you know, for you during a session so you don't have to feel limited to be stuck in a single position. We're still inside. It's still confidential. But you'll be able to move and stretch your body as you like or sit differently. And here's some research on why that's a good thing, you know, mm-hmm. something like that. So you're still grounding it in your original intention, you know, maybe associated with whatever profession you are. But I'm just really appreciative of that. I'm someone, of course, who likes to know what to expect.
Yeah. That's sort of the next step for me. I do it a lot in my workshops. When I train professionals, there's a lot of movement involved. And in part because when you learn something while you're moving, you're more likely to remember it, right? And when you use gesture. So I'll do things like people will write down their values on note cards, and then I'll say, okay, now get up and walk across the room and put this down in terms of how far away you are from those values right now, so that you physically see the distance between where you're sitting here and then where you put those values. And then what would be, if you were to take one step closer, what would that one step be? And the people are actually taking the step. And there's good research to support when you do that, when you do embodied cognition, you'll remember that exercise like 5 years from now, or you remember it when you think about values. Oh, that's me. I'm really far away from my values because you've done it in your body. And part of that, I think, links to some of your other containers, which are the clothing containers, the things that we're wearing that also permit from moving. So if I were to come to therapy in like a short skirt, which I wouldn't do, but, you know, sort of a pencil skirt, I would be less likely to be able to sit on the floor or sit on a ball or go for a walk. There's lots of ways in which we also are confining our movement by what we're wearing. So let's talk a little bit about that and also how it relates to kids.
Well, I guess my famous saying on the matter is, if we have this category of like exercise clothes, then what are all of our other clothes? You know, right? And I think people would say, when you think about it, right, like I would never wear this to be able to move in because my arms don't really go overhead, or I can't really bend without something really cutting into my abdomen or my legs. I couldn't sit cross-legged in these jeans, or like my, you know, we've talked about heels before as something that limits the motion of the foot. So yes, like every day we are, and I organize the containers by the amount of time we spend in them. And so outside of our culture, like you're probably spending most of your time in clothes as the next thing. You get up every morning and you get into your clothing and you're choosing clothing, probably for most listening, based on meeting some other needs, but not the needs that we have to be physically active. So it's just simply starting to wear or choose clothing that allows us more freedom to move around in a variety of positions throughout the day during non-exercise time. And, you know, children, I think we think of them as much more active than we are, you know, and we tend to pick clothes for kids that are rugged, maybe, you know, like things that don't tear or rip as much. But I've worked with a lot of children, and now I can really see that every day a lot of kids are getting into shoes and pants and shirts and jackets that don't allow the movement of the clothes does not match the movement of their joints, and can see it limiting their activities. It's an invisible tether that no one's really recognizing. And we've all got, you know, we have it as well. But we tend to choose it more, you know, what are the professional looking clothes? And then, you know, wanting children to look more nice and more fashionable, but to really make sure that kids are aware that there are outfits that facilitate movement better than other outfits. It's more like, here's how you show a child how to test their clothing for the activities that they would like to do. The one that's the best example is our kids were fortunate enough to go to a nature preschool and kindergarten and early elementary school here. So there's a lot of years and a lot of range of children. And a lot of kids would come to school in like really clunky rain boots, because I live in the Pacific Northwest. And their ability to walk well, walk long distances, to walk on things without falling off, you know, to be able to negotiate. And I'm talking about, you know, a log that's on the ground, you know, and you have no tactile ability. There's thickness. They're so little, and the boots are just oftentimes smaller versions of adult boots, and they're passing over their ankles and sometimes coming right up against their knee. So their joints are braced, are prevented from moving. And then the assumption is these kids aren't just really good outside. You know, this is not the teacher's assumption who had said, this would be the better set of clothes. It's the parents. Like, my kids just doesn't have any coordination. You know, they don't really like to be out there. They don't want to move, without realizing that a lot of times when children can't articulate what's going on, they just want to stop. even though it's frustration and has to do with their garments. Like, it doesn't have to do with their inherent ability to negotiate an environment. It has to do with the gear. It's crappy gear. It doesn't fit. And so just to recognize that that's a factor many times. And then you get, you know, people who develop an aversion for the things that they weren't successful at, and then they keep choosing something else. And so we are always influencing, even what seem to be our natural proclivities are really influenced by those early years. And gear is a big deal. Clothes is a big deal. Maybe people hadn't thought about it before, but I gave it its own chapter.
Yeah. One of the most common complaints I would hear about people having to return back to the office after working from home was, oh, now I have to get dressed. I've been living in my yoga pants for so long, and it's been so great. Like, I've just been so comfortable. I've been working on the floor. I've been, you know, moving about my house. I've been taking a yoga class at lunch or going for a walk during my breaks. And if I put back on these sort of straight jackets of my professional clothing, all of a sudden I feel a little bit stiffer. I have to suck it in a little bit more. I have to, my shoulders are up a little tighter. And, I think it was probably 8-10 years ago when I just went through my closet and I kept one pair, but I just got rid of all of my shoes that were torturing my feet. And at the time, my pinky toe, I think, was glued to my fourth toe. Like, it could not, it was a unit. I only really had four toes. And now I can separate all of my toes. There's like a nice space between every single one of them. And my foot has gotten wider. My shoe size has gone up, but my feet are so much happier. My body is so much happier just from that simple move of changing footwear, but also changing clothing. I mean, I love those tests. Like, can I sit cross-legged in it? Can I squat in it? Can I put my arms go overhead? Can I put my feet up and not have it, you know, fall over my head and my underpants show?
Yeah.
Because I'm probably going to do all of those moves, hopefully, in my day at different points of the day. So yes, so clothing matters for our kids. Clothing matters for us. And I just want to say something related to that, which is the family walk. And you also did a podcast on this recently that was, I think it was one of your talks that you gave. And you gave some suggestions for walking more as a family that was really, they were really helpful for me because they were just sort of new creative ways of thinking about family walks, especially as my kids are a little bit older. So this is related to clothing, but can we just pause on the family walk or walking more and how we can build more of that into our life? Some of the creative ideas and suggestions you have around that?
Well, walking's so great. I mean, so nutritionally, I would say if you think about the food pyramid, the dietary food pyramid, the government food pyramid, it's organized by the things that you need more than others nutritionally. And so if you have that in mind, I put walking at our movement nutrition base. It's a foundational movement. It meets a lot of needs, not only the fact that it moves so many different body parts, and that it also moves the whole body well, moves your whole person from point A to point B. It also fits into many scenarios. It can be used as more than just going to take a walk. It could be used for transportation. It could be used to facilitate other things that you're trying to do. So walking it's a really critical skill. You know, disabilities aside, where you aren't able to walk, it falls into that category in many times of labor that we were talking about. You know, really the fact of getting your body from point A to point B is something that we don't do anymore, but everyone before us did a very large amount of, and it's rapidly disappearing. And the culture, our greater culture, is so car-centric. The places where walking is even possible is dwindling. And then again, our perceptions about what kids can do as far as walking is like, it's a mile. I don't think my kids could walk a mile, right? Which has more to do with skill set and practice than physical capability. Kids can walk much farther than you think you can. They can. So so that talk was 10 ways to get kids moving more, because it is it's a good family connection time. And I'm a big fan of taking movement and inserting it into you getting other things done. So just for kids who are a little bit older, like ours are now, I think our kids maybe are around the same age, maybe mine are a little bit older, but homework. memorizing spelling words and doing spelling tests and memorizing play lines and doing mental math. And all those, it's such a great opportunity for when a kid gets done at the end of the day and does not need to be spending any more time sitting down.
It's the worst thing to do to your kid. They've been sitting in school all day and then make them come home and sit and do homework.
Inside and sit inside. It's like, and then there's no like real family space or connection time. Like the fact that you can go out and take a walk and put all the things that you're talking about that walking and movement does, put all that better memory, better creativity. And kids are such good, they're good at doing multiple things at once. Or maybe like I've just seen it in my kids who are good at fidgeting. Like I have a son who really has a big need for lots of fidgeting kind of movement. And to sit down is really torture for him, as he would say it. But man, he gets something underfoot and he's balancing. He'll rattle off the math. He has no problem. You just have to put in that movement. And then of course, birds are singing. You get sort of the benefit of doing maybe the unschool, homeschool thing where when you move out of your space, learning opportunities are all around you. You spot them. You do not have to go to nature school, but going out in nature on a family walk becomes a DIY nature school. So I like it for that reason. I like it for celebratory reasons. You know, we do a lot of celebration on foot. We do a lot of friend time, community time, out on foot, not always walking. You know, sometimes we'll like our soup and sports night is a really big thing that gets us through winter when we tend to want to go inside and not move as much and not be in outside in nature as much, not be with our friends as much outside of, you know, parties. I'm talking like really low tech, not fancy, bring a pot of soup to a park and a frisbee and a football, makeup games. There's creativity. It brings back that play. All of that can really happen on a walk. And so, I'm a big fan of starting as soon as your children can walk, make it a must. That was one of the tips, because I think that we let movement off the hook. We don't let homework off the hook. We don't let dental hygiene off the hook. We don't let eating off the hook, but we will let movement off the hook every time because we really culturally, collectively are failing to see its value. And so therefore we don't maintain its place.
I loved how you said in that episode, you talked about expecting the wine moving through the wine.
Right.
And I think that's the case for when we're working with kids, they're going to whine the first, you know, and then they kind of get over it. Right. But then also we might whine if we're taking ourselves for a walk. Like we can even expect ourselves to whine. Like, I don't want to, I'm too tired. It's like easier just to relax in my home and it's too much effort, but we can expect the wine from ourselves. We can expect the wine from our children, and you just move through it. And then what happens is this, like there's this shift in momentum where it's like, you succumb to the walk because it starts feeling good. You can't deny it. Like you just start to feel better. You start to get a broader perspective, all that blood flow to your brain and the connection to nature. There's little things that I think that are better for your mental health and especially at the end of the day than going for a walk. And one of the tip you said at the end of your episode to take one away, the one that you're going to take away, and the one that I loved from you was the one-way walk. Like have a parent be at one side and drop the car, and the parent that needs more exercise gets to like sprint back or jog back or whatever to the family as the family just walks one way to get to the destination. And then there's no turning around. It's just sort of like you're going somewhere, whether it's the ice cream shop or the library or whatever it is, getting there is really the goal, which I think evolutionarily fits our walking needs. We're not meant to walk in circles. We're meant to walk to go to something.
and that really, that changed everything, especially when we had really young children. Like we would, for our evening activity, we'd be out for, you know, 2.5 hours, 3 hours. I would pack up dinner. You know, don't feel compelled to have to eat all of your meals sitting down in your house. I mean, they're portable. Food is portable. Humans have always eaten on the move. But it was a nice respite time, especially for parents or alloparents who don't have a lot of time with their children because they're working all day. That's always a nice trade-off. You know, maybe the one who just got home from being away could take the lead on moving the children forward, and the person who has been all the time can still enjoy that family time, you know, that time of connecting with everybody that wants to be involved. but can have a little alone time, a little chance to take a breath. And that was a huge lifesaver for us. Our evening dinner, one way walks. I wanted to share it because I hope more people will be able to use it, especially as the lights are longer and you know, people are still negotiating their, you know, 9 to 5 or whatever hours. I mean, that 9 to 5 more metaphorically, like that hunk of time where you're away and you want to move outside with your family on a weekday, not save it up for a weekend, not have to be on a vacation where you don't feel like it's a regular part of your life. Like, make it part of your regular life, like dinner. You eat dinner every day, even if it's not as fancy as what you eat on vacation or your favorite foods. Get it in there every day. Yeah.
So that brings us to another container, which is probably my favorite container for movement, which is eating and food. And how much, it's just phenomenal when you start to take a look at how much of our food and our eating has been outsourced. Everything from, you know, not growing our food anymore to even just not making our food, or just these subtle ways in which we're kind of not making our food. So we're not, you know, whipping things, or we're not chopping things, we're not grinding things, and the packaging of things. And that's something that has brought so much richness to my family life. And my partnership with my husband is making food together. And it's just culturally, I think it's part of our heritage, it's part of our ancestry, and it's getting lost. And in it is also getting lost sort of these fine motor skills and these digging and these reaching, all these other movements as well.
Yeah, I mean, that's my favorite chapter, the food container, because when you look at why humans move, getting food is the number one reason. You know, it's the primary, and this was, I brought this up in a movie or DNA. It's like the relationship between moving and eating is direct, with really movement being first. You wake up and you're, the only reason you really do need to move is because there's something out there that you need to get. And we've just gotten rid of the need. So it's, you can talk about all the ways we get food from the, on the first level, growing it, you know, having a garden or foraging it, you know, it does not always agricultural base, but then there's just been, again, that steady decline that we talked about, where food has just become both hyper palatable in the dietary nutrition sense, but also hyper palatable in the movement sense, where it's all just like hitting some simple pleasure button, no work required. I mean, and with the pandemic, well, people, you know, were swiping more for their food, including even the groceries. People weren't even walking into the store to get the groceries that were grown someplace else. So we've had another steady decline. Just here again, a big jump. And it's rich, it's celebratory, it's knowledge, it's learning, it's all of the things. You know, again, food and movement are the axis for culture, right? Like we have a very strong food culture. It just looks like what ours looks like, which is much different than all the other very strong food movement cultural axes that were about what was going on in nature and the natural rhythms, you know, the cyclicness of food and what comes and when, and your knowledge of just the environment or landscape that you were in. So when you go towards making your own food, it doesn't have to be all the way to that axis of like what's in season, you know, like what you're harvesting apples and oranges and nuts, and you start to learn what those rhythms are. But it could be as simple as picking out an old family recipe and just doing the work from scratch to make that recipe. It doesn't have to be about in season or even have the nature connection. It can have a familial or your own particular culture, your heritage of where you come from. It can be a great thing to bring into your family. And then, we'll talk about celebrations when we get to the celebration container. But I find that that's a really great way to center all celebrations, is around what are we eating for it?
What I've sort of done is just started to look at all these little contraptions that I have in my house to outsource movement, and trying to not use them as much. So everything from like a nutcracker, when my kids were toddlers, the best activity, if you want like an hour of time, is give them a pile of walnuts and two rocks and they'll sit there and crack the nut and then eat the walnut out and then crack. And it's like a snack. It's a whatever. Cracking nuts is great. Fidget spinners, like having kids get some, we grow fava beans because it's helpful to the soil, to the nutrients of the soil. But the whole fava bean experience is a fidget spinner because you have to like take the fava beans out of the pods. And then each little fava bean has a little skin on it. So you have to take the little skin off. All these things that could just be a fun activity. You talk to your kid while you shell fava beans. I mean, it's at that level, I feel like it's family time. It's making food time. It's movement time. But what people will say is that takes too much time. And I will say maybe, yeah, it takes a lot of time. But at the end of that time, what I get from that is really deeply linked to my values, which is spending time with my family and moving my body and having a connection to nature, as opposed to talking about the environment and reading about the environment. We're experiencing the environment.
And that's great to do with older people too. I mean, like I grew up cracking nuts as a young child, like your young children are, but my parents weren't there doing it with me. All the elders of the community, that was their task to sort of do it with the younger children. And that's where they connected and they stayed physically active and were contributing to the food. You know, that was the motion that best suited them. And it's really beautiful to see that full ecology in practice of restoring some of those movements that are related to food. And again, the seasons is really great.
Yeah. I want to pause on elders real quick before we go to celebrations, because you wrote dynamic aging. And as I am aging and as I'm watching my parents age, I have been thinking more and more about the importance of movement in healthy aging and just lifespan and health span. And my mom and I were on a retreat in Costa Rica this past week, and we were going up and down these like stairs that were made out of rocks, kind of carved into the jungle. And she was climbing up them, and she was saying, you know, I was talking about how I was going to be talking with you. And she said, you know, the thing that I've really learned from Katie is I'm not like leaning on handrails as much. I'm trying to see if my body can get up the stair without using the handrail to get up. Because there were no handrails in Costa Rica. She had no option. And she was able to do it. And she was able to, in the yoga class that we took, lie on her back and reach her feet and grab a hold of her feet in like a happy baby pose. I looked over and I was like, oh, my mom could reach her feet. That's such a good sign that I've heard you talk about too. Like these things that actually mean something later on when you need to take care of your feet as you're aging, and it can actually cause a lot of problems if you can't. So talk about just briefly around like aging and movement and how it links to just our health span in the long run.
Our health span and I would say our range of experiences. To me, I think that I just got, have you read Atul Gawande's Being Mortal? Mm-hmm. I feel like it's a must read for every human, certainly every American. Like I would put that out there because it's about what to expect as we get older in a way that is completely different than what I talk about. But those books really go together well, Dynamic Aging and Being Mortal, because Being Mortal really shows you as you get older, what becomes important to you are your best days, you know, having your best days. And of course, as you get older, there's an inevitable decline that happens and you're going to have a decrease, especially if you have illness that comes up, but how to still have your best day no matter what, and then have a team of people who understand and are working also towards your best day. But your best day often involves some physicality. And there's a large portion of that book about gerontology, which I really liked when I was an undergraduate. I took a lot of gerontology classes because the things, and gerontology has sort of gone away as a field. Because there's nothing to gerontology except, well, I don't want to say nothing for all the gerontologists who are out there. The bulk of what makes up gerontology is here's how to take care of your body, keep it strong, eating well. It's the same things that we all need because we are all aging. We are all aging always. I mean, that's just what's happening to us. And this idea that oftentimes the physical decline that we experience as we get older is compounded by the fact that we are in a sedentary environment. It's not really only your age that is creating the physical experience that you're having. It's more the length of habit that you've had of not using certain parts. And we just sort of make this transition, like your mother was saying, oh, there's a handrail. I'm going to use it for safety, which is great. But the idea of using it for balance versus training your arm to pull harder just also allows your legs to not have to maintain the strength. And then what happens when you are presented to go to a place that doesn't have handrails, or the handrail is loose and then you depend on it and then you fall? And like a lot of injuries, like I study biomechanics, that's what I study. And how do falls, slips, and trips occur is when you were operating in your environment and something unexpected happened that you couldn't deal with physically, because our range of movements in a younger, healthier person is already pretty low because our environment is so fixed and we move in it so often. And then you compound it by the fact that there are other changes that are happening. And then you're ripe for a situation that sets you on a path where movement rapidly declines. And so I'm passionate about movement, but if I were to target a group, it would be the dynamic agers, the goldeners, and the children. Like, you can either start it super, super fresh, or you can start it right now if you feel like you're a dynamic ager, and you're going to get a very big return on it because you're starting from a place of being more sedentary than you probably realize.
Yeah, or just more doing the same thing over and over and over again. My dad, who's a competitive bicyclist, his body is like, it's 70-something. He's still riding 67 miles, but his body looks like a bicycle.
Sure, that's what happens.
Or like it's on a bicycle. Yeah. He can't reach the back of his head to the ground.
No, doesn't have a balanced movement diet.
No. And so it's like, how do we have more of that variety? Well, when we're closing, I do want to bring in this concept of celebration. And one of the ways that you celebrate your birthday every year is walking. You have a walking birthday party, which I love. And in your last one, you asked people about their favorite walk. And you go, and it was just lovely, like, it's like almost like a little documentary, like listening to people's favorite walks. And so I thought it would be nice for us to talk briefly about celebrations, but then maybe share our favorite walks with each other. And maybe the listeners can think about their favorite walks as we're sharing them.
Right. So celebration has, again, always been a big movement time throughout the human timeline. And I really tried to call out celebration to meaning like all big, noting something monumental happening with the expression of emotions and grief. I put grief into the chapter as well, because grief, I could do a whole episode on grief and movement, but we'll save that for now. So it's not always all 100% birthday parties. It's this idea that anything monumental was always celebrated with a lot of movement, and that movement is all missing. And so what's going on with us as we go through these emotional landscapes? And making it movement rich, whether that means doing more food by hand, whether it's making the one small thing that is traditional for you and not just buying it, you know, already made, but spending the day making it, or a few hours getting people involved, inviting people over to your house so that the celebration can go on longer. You know, this idea that I'm thinking about that comment of like, this takes so much time to make it by hand. Mm-hmm. But it's the idea of seeing the celebration grow beyond the 17 minutes where you sat down and consumed the meal or the thing, and more like, I had to make this dough 3 days before and let it rise, or I had to plant the corn 4 months before. And you are in the celebratory mindset and the space and the intention so much longer. And I have now realized that I mostly exist in a celebratory space. And simultaneously, most of my life is filled with mundane movement tasks. But because I've oriented them towards celebrations, I can live in a celebratory space all the time. And I feel much more connected to my roots that really were able to do that most of their time. You know, life is full of mundane tasks. Women have had the burden of doing many mundane tasks for a long period of time, but they need to be done. And I don't know that my tasks need to be done by someone else. You know, like I don't feel particularly liberated from my tasks if someone else is just doing them. So to change my understanding around them and being like, oh, this is part of the celebration. I have come to find great joy in chores, something that my mom finds mind-boggling because like every person, child, like I hated chores. Like I couldn't see their relationship. And now, you know, my kids too hate chores, but we also do a lot of things that I know are chores that they think are celebration. And so in that way, I've really been able to find more movement, I guess, in the mundane.
Absolutely. Yes, we find movement in the mundane. We do a lot of laundry folding on the floor while watching basketball games together as a family, and it's kind of fun. But I think the celebration aspect you're talking about, also just the anticipation and the preparation, which is very much part of when you look at sort of some of the research, it's actually the preparing and anticipation of something that brings us the most joy, even more joy than the actual doing of it. It's like the planning of the birthday walk and who you're going to invite and how you're going to do it. So in closing, why don't you share with me what has been one of your favorite walks that you've ever done? And then I can share one of mine.
Oh my gosh, I've had so many great walks. I'll just pick out one that was more recent. My son turned 9 in April, 2 weeks after lockdown in the pandemic, so a couple of years ago. And we decided we were still going to do our, you know, celebration of walking our years on foot. So we had 9 miles to walk. But I sent out an email to all of his friends saying we would be here. And if they wanted to do anything along the way, you know, to go for it. And that walk was, I mean, we were met by people throwing flower petals, people leaving chalk signs, people hanging happy birthday posters, leaving treats or bringing things all along the way. So it was 9 miles. It was a, you know, 5 hours of walking. People would go by music, serenading. Like it was like a full community event, one community member at a time, all outside. And I don't know if we could have had a better 9-year-old birthday party. I don't know if one will ever be more memorable than that walk. And it was great. And then, you know, our whole family goes, and to have the children just involved and just seeing people show up, like it was really great. It was a wonderful day.
Yeah.
What about you?
I have lots of kids ones, but since my mom is in my mind, probably my favorite was when she turned 70 and I turned 40. She invited me to go to Peru with her, which is where she grew up. And I had never been. And when we were driving from Cusco into the Sacred Valley of Peru, the bus driver said, we're going to drop you off here at this top of this mountain so you can walk into the Sacred Valley, because it's so much better to walk in than to drive in. And they dropped us off at these like salt fields, like where they were mining salt, this beautiful pink salt. And my mom and I and this group of people walked pretty much silently from the salt fields down into the valley. And it was like this return to something with her. And to do it with her in that way felt so sacred. Sacred Valley, as opposed to just sort of driving in and landing and getting here and, you know, and here it is. The slowing it down in that way made it ever more special. And to spend that time with my mom is just, I will always hold that as a memory, even when she's gone. So walking into something, I think, changes your whole experience of it.
Yeah, lovely.
Yeah. Thank you, Katie. I'm sure we'll be able to talk again, I hope. And always looking forward to your next book, because you have a million of them.
I'm prolific.
Keep on coming. I know you're writing another one. I'm looking forward to that. And everyone gets better, and then all the oldies are still goodies. So thank you so much for who you are, what you do, how you've changed my family's life. And if you're new to Katie Bowman, you're welcome.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Okay. Take care. So Katie and I talked about the benefits of nutritious movement. In many ways, moving more isn't more. It's actually moving in a variety of ways so that all your different body parts get moved, so that you are moving in community with others, and so that you are also moving more in nature. And we talked about these different containers which either confine our movement or can support our movement. This week, I want you to look at some of these containers for yourself and bring more movement into the different containers. So you have the culture container. What rules, what cultural rules could you break this week using some of your psychological flexibility and your cognitive flexibility? Break a rule around movement. It could be something as simple as an adult walking the balance beam of a curb or hanging from a tree or sitting on the floor in your office space. Break a rule. The second container we talked about is your clothing container. I want you to go through your shoes and your clothes and do a little bit of a Marie Kondo movement style. What shoes really limit your ability to walk, run, jump? And what shoes have more flexibility and allow you to move more in your life? Same thing with your clothes. Pull out some clothes and shoes that support your movement and make a commitment to wearing those shoes and clothes more frequently. And then third, let's take a look at your cooking container. How can you build more movement into your cooking, whether that's growing food, chopping food, walking to food, or walking with food? How can you build movement back in, looking at some of your ancestry, some of your parents' traditions, and bring those back into your life? And then how can you build more movement into your home container? How can you set up your spaces to encourage movement? In our living room, we don't have a couch. We just have a big open space. Sometimes we put a ping pong table in it. Sometimes we put a foosball table in it. Sometimes we're just sitting on the floor and playing board games in it. We also don't have any furniture in front of screens so that we encourage ourselves to move if we're going to be doing an activity like watching a movie or a sports game. How can you make some subtle changes in your home and in your office space to encourage more movement? And then finally, celebration. What could you do to bring more movement into your celebrations? Dancing, music, cooking, walking, outdoor celebrations, whatever you like, but plan one of your upcoming celebrations with the mindset of movement. How could we make this movement rich? All right. Try out those things. You can download all of them as your daily practice. And I'm so curious what you do. I'll have some images up on Instagram so you can see some of my house and some of my office. But I also encourage you to check out the YouTube video where I show my office space a little bit and do some posting of your own of how you're bringing more movement into your life. Thanks so much for listening, and I look forward to hearing from you. Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Your Life in Process. When you enter your life in process, when you become psychologically flexible, you become free. If you like this episode or think it would be helpful to somebody, please leave a review over at podchaser.com. And if you have any questions, you can leave them for me by phone at 805-457-2776 or send me a voicemail by email at podcast@yourlifeinprocess.com. I want to thank my team, Craig, Angela Stubbs, Ashley Hyatt, Abby Deal, and thank you to Ben Gold at Bell & Branch for his original music. This podcast is for informational and entertainment purposes only, and it's not meant to be a substitute for mental health treatment.